full of people, all alone. Roads full of houses, never home. Church full of singing, out of tune. Everyone's gone to the moon. Eyes full of sorrow, never wet. Hands full of money, all in debt. Sun coming out in the middle of June. Everyone's gone.
From the City of Angels, Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
For a number of years, there have been people who claim that the Apollo astronauts never really landed on the moon and that the whole thing was faked. Now, July 20th, 1969, as I was huddled around the television set with my dad and my mom in Detroit, I remember hearing this while watching television.
Hey, that's down. 320 feet. 15 forward. Up forward, come down nicely. 200 feet. 4.5 down. 5.5 down. Within 50, 6.5 down. 5.5 down. 9 forward. Good. Within 20 feet. 100 feet, 3.5 down. 9 forward. 5%. How many bites? 875 feet. That is looking good. Down a half. 6 forward. 60 seconds. Lights on. 6. Down 2.5. Forward. Forward. 30 feet down, 2.5. Picking up from dust. 30 feet, 2.5 down. Fake shadow. 4 forward. 4 forward, drifting to the right level. 8.5.
30 seconds.
Forward, just. 8. Contact light. Okay, engine stop. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
It still sends chills when I hear that. In a moment, our guest, Marcus Allen, will get his thoughts on going to the moon. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Marcus Allen is the British distributor and publisher of the UK edition of Nexus magazine. Nexus, of course, deals with news and information that is overlooked, underreported, ignored by the mainstream media. Subjects covered include hidden history, future science, alternative health issues, conspiracies, and yes, UFOs. And like many others, Marcus watched the Apollo moon landings live on television and at that time applauded the evident success of those missions. After attending a lecture 10 years ago which questioned the validity of the moon landings, he decided to carry out his own research. Having worked as a photographer in London in the 1960s, Marcus was able to examine the well-known photographs issued by NASA from a professional viewpoint. He has also researched many other aspects of Apollo. He has given many public presentations on this subject, during which he always asks for someone to prove him wrong. To date, he says no one has. He has reluctantly come to the conclusion that it is beyond reasonable doubt some manipulation of the Apollo record has taken place. He is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Marcus, welcome to the program. How are things in England, my friend?
Thank you, George. It's just dawning in England at the moment.
Excellent.
So we're a wee bit ahead of you, so I can tell you that tomorrow will happen.
Well, I hope so, because they keep talking about England would be the first to get involved in this possible new ice age one day, and I hope that never occurs out there.
Well, it's an interesting subject, that one, all to do with the Gulf Stream.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to get you back one day for another show on that. So tell me, you went to a lecture 10 years ago, and is that what kind of got you fascinated about this Apollo landing or not?
Yeah, it was. About 10 years ago, it was actually an American who was giving the lecture, which was what was so interesting. David Childress of Adventures Unlimited.
Oh, yes, no, David.
Yeah, he's well done. And he was showing some slides and put some photographs up, which pictures that most people are very familiar with, the Apollo 11 landings. And he pointed out a few things about them, and I thought, hey, that's interesting. Now, at that time, I was a photographer. I'd used the equipment that was used on, similar equipment to the one used on Apollo, the Hasselblad cameras, and I thought, I'm going to have a look at this. I'm going to find out if what he's talking about has got any validity, any truth in it. And the more I looked, the more I found that there were significant problems with it. I say quite openly, I say that there are three things I believe in: Father Christmas, the Tooth Fairy, and God.
Mm-hmm.
For everything else, I want evidence.
Sure.
So let's have a look for the evidence. And the more I looked, the more I found questions, not confirmation, which is what I was looking for. I thought, you know, like you say, I watched the Apollo moon landings. I watched them live. I was living in London at the time. And I stayed up. It happened at 3 o'clock in the morning.
For you, yeah. That's right, yeah.
For us, so I'd been up all night, and I thought, I've got to watch this. This is history. I want to be a part of it. And I was blown away by it. I thought, this is fantastic. Like half the world's population, we watched it, and we really did believe that what we were watching was the truth, the pure, unadulterated truth. It was on the television, wasn't it? It was live from the moon. That's what it said. We believed it. And it was then, like 10 years ago, that I started saying, well, was it live? You played that very famous sequence.
Absolutely.
Landing.
It was chilling for me, Marcus, to hear it again.
I know. I mean, we were on the edge of our seat. It was better than any thriller. It was an extraordinary moment. Man's on the moon. I remember looking out of the window and thinking, there's a man on the moon. This is great. This is fantastic. Man can do anything. And also, remember at the time, we're talking 1969, July 1969, over in the UK, Concorde was just becoming well known. It was just
beginning
to fly. I mean, these were wonderful days.
It might have been, at least in our immediate history, one of the most glorious days for humankind. I think, if I remember, I was 19 years old, it was euphoric that day. I mean, the people were happy, they were friendly. I mean, it was an incredible moment.
It was. It was the first real event that everybody in the world could understand, take part in, and feel a part of. And it was the first event that really did bring people together. And as you say, people were euphoric. People were excited. It was science in action.
Now, I'm going to ask you the big question now, and then we're going to back into this. Do you believe that we, as people, not just Americans, but as people, that we went to the moon, or do you believe that we did not go and fudge the photographs, or do you also believe maybe we did go but we altered the photographs for other purposes?
That's a very good point. I would like to be able to argue that somebody has been to the moon, because getting to the moon wasn't really a problem. Even back then, it wasn't really a problem. The rockets were certainly powerful enough to get there. The ability to direct craft towards the moon rather than somewhere else was certainly available. To get to the moon wasn't a problem. The real problem was getting back. That's the key. Getting there isn't a problem. Getting back was the real difficult part.
Why? Because, you know, we saw the lunar module, the LEM, I guess, blast off from the moon, and it successfully attached itself to the command capsule, and off they went back to Mother Earth. Why would it be so difficult?
The sheer ability to do so. Now, let's just have a look at it. Okay, when you're going to the moon, basically you can see where you're going from the moment you leave. It's like sailing a boat on an ocean. If you can see where you're going, you just point towards it, and the tides may take you a bit up and down, but
you'll get there eventually, yeah.
You can see where you're going.
Yeah.
Coming back, yes, the Earth is a big thing, but the Earth is very dangerous from the point of view of man trying to get onto it if he's coming from outside the Earth. What he has to do is to enter the Earth's atmosphere at a very precise angle and at a very precise speed. Now, he can control the angle, but the speed is something which is dictated by gravity. The gravitational attraction of the Earth is very powerful compared to the Moon.
True.
As a spacecraft comes towards the Earth, or as anything comes towards the Earth, it is attracted with increasing speed towards it.
Now,
gravity.
Okay, are you saying, because this is an important point here, are you saying that this approach from the Moon to the Earth was so much more dangerous than, let's say, our Gemini missions, the Gemini missions, when we were just orbiting the planet and then coming back in through the atmosphere?
Exactly.
Okay.
Much more difficult. Now, if you're in Gemini or Mercury, or if you're in the space shuttle, or if you're in Mir, or if you're in any of the Russian craft, the Soyuz craft, if you're in orbit around Earth, your orbit speed is about 17,500 miles an hour. All right, very fast, but nowhere near as fast as the speed you would approach Earth from outside, i.e. from the Moon.
Okay.
You're approaching Earth at the speed you leave it, 25,000 miles an hour. And spacecraft don't have brakes. All right, they have rockets to direct their angle
of
approach.
Sure.
But they don't have brakes. You can't say, whoops, start again, go around one more time and come in. No, you have one hit at it, and that's it. Now, as you approach the Earth, you have to hit it at a certain angle. If you hit it at too shallow an angle, because you're going so fast, you will literally bounce off the atmosphere and go into orbit around the sun.
And it's history time then.
Definitely history. If you come in at too steep an angle, you will burn up.
And ultimately,
as we saw very tragically a couple of years ago.
Exactly. And then disintegrate.
And then, yes, and you don't get a second chance. So this envelope, if you like, this little entry point for a craft approaching the Earth from outside the atmosphere, from outside orbit, from the Moon, is an envelope 40 miles wide and about 6 miles high. You have to enter it at a very precise angle on the Earth's atmosphere, and then the craft is designed to absorb the heat of the friction of the atmosphere, and that's where you get the heat shields on the spacecraft to absorb this heat. It will absorb sufficient heat to slow the craft down, and then the parachutes can be deployed. Now, if you can imagine, you're standing on top of the Empire State Building, and I'm standing at the bottom with a beer glass. You're standing on top with a marble, 1 inch in diameter. I'm standing at the bottom with my beer glass, 3 inches in diameter. I have to catch the marble you drop from the top of the Empire State Building in my beer mug 6 times without missing once.
Well, chances are you probably wouldn't even see it.
Exactly. That is the accuracy with which the spacecraft has to enter the Earth's atmosphere, or it bounces off or burns up.
However, if that model had my mathematics behind it and had little tiny rockets on it and everything else that went along with the capsule that re-entered, couldn't I have found my way, assuming I was in the similar kind of situation, couldn't I have found my way into your beer glass?
You could have done if you could have steered the craft, if you could have maneuvered the craft, if you had rockets that were, or maneuvering systems that could bring it in. It's like a plane landing on an aircraft carrier at sea. The plane has to line itself up because it can see it all the time. If the plane gets the angle of approach wrong onto an aircraft carrier, it can take off and go around again and try one more time.
Sure.
With a spacecraft, you can't do that. You can't go around one more time.
No, you get one shot, that's it.
You get one shot, and then you've got to come in, and you've got to make sure you get everything right. And you don't have the option of maneuvering. You have to line it up. And if you recall on Apollo 13, the famous time where they didn't land on the moon mm-hmm. because of problems on the craft, the craft was lined up by eye. They literally looked out of the window and lined up the Earth coming back. And this seems a bit unlikely given the actual accuracy required for re-entry.
Well, now, do you have... It's going to be a fascinating night with you tonight, Marcus, because, you know, I've always believed that we landed on the moon, and you're going to have to convince me otherwise, I think, by the end of tonight. But I'm open to talking with you about it. I don't think anything's preposterous, I think, but at the same time, you know, there's some things that I've always believed. Now, you may say to me, what proof do you have, George? I don't have any. I mean, I'm going on faith, and you know, same with the rocket, the rocks. We have moon rocks, sure. But if you were to ask me if I've ever seen them, no. And how would I know they came from the moon? I wouldn't. That's what they told me.
Exactly.
But I mean, are you basing a lot of this then on the fact that we had so many successful re-entries with Apollo?
We have eight successful re-entries on Apollo. Apollo 8 didn't land on the moon. Apollo 9 didn't go to the moon. It was in Earth orbit. Apollo 10 didn't land on the moon but re-entered Earth. Apollo 13 didn't land on the moon but came back and re-entered. The others all landed. That's Apollo 11, 12, 14, and so on. So there were nine missions that went out beyond Earth orbit. And this is the key to it. Everything in space that we read about today, the space shuttle, the space station, the Hubble Space Telescope, everything occurs in low Earth orbit.
True.
This is about 250 miles up.
Okay.
Not very far, about the distance between Washington and New York. Not very far in terms of space. It's quite a long way in terms of man. In Earth, low Earth orbit, in the space station, the space shuttle, everything happens below what are called the Van Allen radiation belts.
Okay.
Named after Professor James Van Allen, who was the first man to identify them precisely in 1958. The Van Allen radiation belts are the safety net around Earth. They are basically belts of radiation held in place by the Earth's magnetic field. The Earth has a pretty strong magnetic field, and these belts of radiation, the radiation in turn is generated by the sun, as all energy is generated that we use on Earth by the sun. This radiation, parts of it, are extremely dangerous to man. We basically couldn't survive. You recall hearing about these holes in the ozone layer above the Arctic and the Antarctic?
Sure.
And how if they get any bigger, the radiation will get through, we'll all get cancer and die. This is dangerous stuff, this radiation, so we need protection. Without getting into the rights and wrongs of holes in the ozone layer, all it tells us is that radiation from the sun is not only dangerous, it's very helpful to us on Earth. We need it, but we only need certain parts of it. The dangerous parts we could do without, and fortunately the Earth is designed in such a way that allows the radiation to, the helpful radiation to come through and the good and the bad radiation not. Now, it's equivalent of you going out in a rainstorm. Now, if you don't have an umbrella, you're going to get wet.
You're going to get soaked.
You're going to get soaked. If you have an umbrella, you can protect yourself against pretty well all rainstorms except possibly a tropical monsoon.
Correct.
But then it's not so cold.
Which
so
will then
really
fold
matter.
Your umbrella inside out, probably.
You've got a problem. So if you imagine the Van Allen radiation belts are the umbrella against the radiation generated by the sun. So the radiation would be the rain, the Van Allen radiation belts would be the umbrella, and you would be the Earth. As long as you stay under your umbrella, you're going to stay moderately dry. If you go outside your umbrella, if you go outside the Van Allen radiation belts, you're exposed to radiation.
Well, what if your capsule has then become an umbrella?
The capsule would be an umbrella, and if it was light drizzle, the capsule would be quite acceptable and good protection. If the radiation is in the form of a tropical storm, the capsule may not be sufficient. Now, what you've got to look at is the intensity of the radiation. From background radiation, which could be a light drizzle, to tropical radiation, which could be a tropical storm, which could be the severe levels of radiation that we know are lethal to man.
All right, stay with us, Marcus. We're going to take this quick break. We'll be back. I want to continue talking about the Van Allen radiation belt, and then also we'll get into some of these photographs as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
Get it in writing with the After Dark newsletter. Subscribe by calling 1-888-727-5505. Somewhere out there, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Hey, hearing ghost stories is great fun, but you ever stop to wonder where they come from? Well, you can by reading all about it in the After Dark newsletter. You'll also get a free CD, Art Bell's interview on Mel's Hole, when you subscribe or renew the After Dark newsletter. Call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Marcus Allen. He is the distributor, publisher of the United Kingdom's edition of Nexus Magazine, his website, nexusmagazine.com. Marcus, let's pick up again with the radiation belt, and then we'll get into some of these photographs that were allegedly taken of the moon. And again, I'll ask you shortly if you think we did go to the moon or not. But go ahead. Now let's pick it up with the Van Allen belt again.
Okay, the Van Allen belts, these are belts of intense radiation, concentrated radiation. And virtually anybody you speak to will tell you that if you're going to go through them, you've got to go through them pretty fast. And certainly the Saturn V rocket going to the moon, allegedly, went through them very fast, 25,000 miles an hour. It would have spent about an hour and a half, 2 hours going through these belts. And we're told that this is quite acceptable and there wouldn't be sufficient exposure to dangers for any astronauts in these radiation belts. And once they're out the other side, of course, no problem, bright sunlit uplands, and we can just cruise our way to the moon and everything's going to be jolly. Well, that's what we've been asked to believe. The trouble is, that isn't actually as simple as it sounds. Because these belts of radiation, as ask any scientist who has examined them and done experiments with them, and to be fair, there aren't many people who can answer with a degree of first-hand knowledge, because it's very hard to get information about the levels of radiation and the exposure that they will have on man.
But can you imagine the secret that they would have to have kept with all those hundreds of thousands of employees and technicians and astronauts to keep quiet for so many years?
Oh, I can. I think at the height of the Apollo program in the mid-1960s, there were upwards of 400,000 people working directly on parts of the program.
And to
These people were based right across America, from Oregon to Florida, from California to Washington.
But, you know, with whistleblowers, Marcus, are everywhere. I mean, the CIA can't have a document without it getting into the media, getting in our hands. To my knowledge, not one Apollo employee has come forward to say, this is a hoax. I work there. Here are my credentials. I don't know of any. Do you?
There are some, yes, there are some. Now, it's a question that I get asked many times. As you said in the introduction, I do public presentations in the UK on this subject, and this is the question I'm virtually guaranteed to be asked. Why didn't anybody blow the whistle? And, in fact, there's a follow-up question to that as well. We'll come to it in a minute. Most of the people who were working on Apollo, in fact, virtually everybody working on Apollo, were doing the very best job they could. They were designing the best rockets they could, the best control panels, control centers. They were doing the job that they were asked to do. They weren't questioning it. They were like you and like me at the time and like virtually everybody else who was alive at that time and aware of what was going on. We wanted it to happen. We were saying, go for it, go for it, get on with it, do it, get there. We wanted this to be successful. You've got to look at Apollo in the context of its times. This is the mid to late 1960s. What else was going on at that time? There was the Vietnam War. It was turning very nasty. Mm-hmm. There was the space race. The Russians had beaten America into virtually every space first.
We were in the early 60s of the Cuban Missile Crisis, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That had shaken everybody. I was aware very much of that happening at the time. We genuinely thought the world was about to end. I mean, it's very hard to grasp today with the knowledge that we have of what did happen at that time, exactly how dangerous we felt the situation was. And it was a very dangerous situation. So there was a great deal of fear. There was a great deal of unhappiness. And we wanted to believe that our governments were telling us the truth. President Kennedy, in the early 1960s, he was the man who faced down Khrushchev.
Absolutely.
He was the man who had issued the famous challenge. We will land a man on the moon before the decade is out and return him safely to the Earth. This was a fantastic challenge for the American people, for the people of the world. All right, it was the American people who did it, and the rest of the world, us, we were standing there clapping and cheering and saying, go for it, get it, score the goal.
Of course.
And we wanted this to happen. Now, the Vietnam War comes along, very unpleasant. The space race has been going on throughout the 1960s. And to be fair, America don't have the option of coming second to anybody.
True.
Especially the Russians.
And we're in this Cold War.
It's very, very nasty. we're on the side of the good guys, and we don't want the bad guys to win. It's pretty simple compared to what we have today. So looking at it in the context of the time, yes, we wanted it to succeed. Yes, there were 400,000 people, plus probably a million of their families, people directly connected with employees at all the major companies working to produce parts of Apollo. All this was going on, and everybody wanted it to succeed. Now, it's only, as I say, I first heard about it only 10 years ago. This is in the 1990s. Nobody questioned it, though I do recall at the time there were people who doubted that what they were watching was anything other than a rather poorly designed Hollywood film set.
Well, now, let me ask you this, though, Marcus. If you're correct and we did not go to the moon, I'll play the devil's advocate here for a moment,
okay,
then what was the purpose of this? Was it to create jobs? Was it to spend money? Was it a PR campaign to scare the Soviets at the time? That we could do it, you can't, you better stay away, therefore our missiles may be better than yours. What was the reason for the illusion?
It was primarily to... It was basically propaganda. As I say, it was necessary for America to demonstrate its technological superiority over the Soviet Union. In doing so, the rest of the world, the spectators cheering around the edges, if you like, could be persuaded that the American ability and belief and open society that was quite evident was the more successful and should be supported. It was also a diversionary factor. We mentioned the Vietnam War. This was not a very pleasant experience for anybody who'd lived through it. There were a considerable amount of protests going on. If you remember, the Tet Offensive in 1968 had really brought it into our living rooms at the time. We watched it as you watched it. There were things needed. Now, it sounds very cynical to say that the Apollo program was just a diversionary factor from other far more unpleasant things going on. But what other purpose did it have? It was initiated by John Kennedy, President Kennedy, but at the time he issued his challenge in 1961, it was May 1961 in his address to the Joint Houses of Congress, no American had been into space. This is Alan Shepard had been up about 100 miles and come straight down again. John Glenn wasn't to orbit the Earth until the following year, 1962.
And he went around, what, three times, something like that?
Three times.
Yeah.
But Yuri Gagarin had already been up and orbited. So it was necessary for America to take up the challenge and be seen to succeed. Now, at some point, a decision would have to have been made. Can we actually land a man on the moon? Now, don't forget, at this point, President Kennedy had been assassinated in November 1963.
Sure. Now, were we truly attempting to go to the moon?
Oh, definitely attempting to go to the moon.
Absolutely. Right.
No dispute, no doubt whatsoever about that. The rockets were designed to do exactly that. They had to lift a 50-ton payload, not into Earth orbit, but into moon orbit. They were big enough. Anybody who's seen the pictures and the films of the Saturn V rockets taking off, which in fact are very similar in power and visual drama to the space shuttle taking off today, those were real rockets. There were real astronauts on top of them. Everything that was made for the Apollo program was real.
Well, when these astronauts were launched, where did they end up going if they didn't go to the moon?
Okay, we have two options here. The worst-case scenario is that at some point somebody decided it's going to be far too dangerous to send real live men out into space where we don't know what's going to happen to them. Let's put them into Earth orbit, keep them in Earth orbit.
Which we've demonstrated we can do, right?
Oh, we can do that quite easily.
Yeah.
The Mercury and Gemini craft had demonstrated Earth orbit was not a dangerous place, relatively speaking.
True.
So the worst-case scenario is launch the Saturn V rocket, live on television, as we all saw, 2 minutes after launch, it disappears into space, and now we have to rely on NASA to tell us what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
The astronauts go into Earth orbit and stay there. And then after the elapsed time of the mission, whether it's 8 days for Apollo 11 or 12 days for Apollo 17, they come back down into the Pacific on their parachutes live on television. And so we can see the beginning and the end. In the middle, we're told everything that's going on by NASA. They had already done a great deal of training and simulation. They had done real-time simulation exercises. If it was an eight-day mission, they did an eight-day simulation.
Right,
these
I
simulations,
agree with that. Which was smart to do, right?
You would expect it.
Yeah.
And there were simulation sets. These were not secret at all. A lot of people knew about it. A lot of people were filming them. There were about five major sets right across America.
I think Cronkite used to go to those every once in a while during the coverage to say, you know, let's go to a simulator. Let's take a look at this or that.
Sure. Yeah.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't Wally Schirra sitting next to him on some of these productions? And they went to a simulator, and you could see what was going to be happening on the moon.
Absolutely, yeah. And they designed it as realistically as possible. I mean, I have photographs. I have the research I've done has turned up some very interesting photographs.
Okay, well, you won't get an argument from me that we didn't have those sets. I believe we did, too.
Absolutely, okay. And they were very realistic.
Yes.
Now, this is a worst-case scenario. They've gone into Earth orbit and stayed there.
Yep.
And everything that we have seen demonstrating the landing on the moon was filmed during the simulation exercises, and the photographs were taken by good professional photographers employed by NASA. These were all part of the PR exercise to demonstrate to the American people that the $40 billion that Apollo ultimately cost had been well spent. And we were persuaded. I was persuaded, I'm sure you were, I'm sure many people listening were persuaded that the Apollo missions were successful. Now, that's the worst case scenario. The best case scenario is that they were launched exactly as we saw. They went into Earth orbit, as we knew they would do, for a couple of orbits, and then they launched for the moon. They get to the moon, they get out, they take the photographs that we've subsequently seen, walk around a bit, get back in their lunar lander, go back into moon orbit, come back to the Earth, land successfully, as we all watched on television.
True.
Then they go and develop the photographs. Oh, dear. They're all fogged.
They're all fogged.
They're totally all useless. We can't use them.
Right.
At that time, if you recall, everybody, every magazine, Life magazine, Look magazine, all the major magazines, National Geographic, they all wanted these famous moon photographs.
I would agree with this. This is a strong possibility.
So, the photographs that were taken by the real astronauts on the moon are totally useless and cannot possibly be used. Somebody at that point might have said, okay, now, remember those ones we did on the simulation exercise? We could use those.
Yeah, they'll say, well, who would know the difference? So
who would know the difference? Nobody else has been to the moon. So that's what they did.
All right, and let me add a third caveat to this, then
okay.
to get your take, and then we'll try to fill in the gaps here on how this may have been done. They go to the moon. We launch for the moon. They land on the moon. And all of a sudden, oh, my God, they see extraterrestrial spaceships there. They see things that they didn't want us to know about, maybe ancient artifacts on the moon, who knows what. And they were so prevalent that the photographs that they did take, they couldn't show us. And so when they were done with their mission, they came back and also said, we better show some recreated pictures because we're not showing the ones we took. Is that possible?
Absolutely. Of course that's possible. That's a very, very real possibility. And in fact, it's probably the most frightening of them all.
Yes.
Because in two aspects. One is that if there is evidence of intelligent life having been on the moon at some point, it may not be there right now, but it would have demonstrated that some intelligent life had been onto the moon at some early point in our history.
There was always talk, Marcus, that Neil Armstrong looked across a crater and saw a huge object. And, I mean, I remember seeing and reading about things like that. Don't you?
Oh, yeah. I've heard the story. In fact, I've heard somebody who was allegedly in the next-door hotel room to Neil Armstrong in Rome when he apparently said this. Now, there's a very interesting point about this. It's a very plausible explanation for why the Apollo photographs have been manipulated. Now, one has to take into account one other factor.
And that is?
Disinformation.
True. Absolutely true. And we've seen what governments can do with disinformation.
I mean, one only has to ask the question, do you believe everything your government tells you about everything all the time? And if the answer to that is no, where do you draw the line?
True.
Where do you say, I believe that, but I'm not sure about that?
And if you say yes, I think you're being pretty darn naive.
I think we've had pretty good demonstrations of that recently, but let's not get into that one. Now, if the story, this famous story of Neil Armstrong saying, they're over there, they're huge, they're looking at us, type of thing, is true, then because he said it when he was on the moon, the reasonable assumption is that the transmission in which he said it is recorded, as all transmissions were. You played one of the ones that right at the beginning of the show. I've never heard that transmission. I've only seen transcripts, alleged transcripts of it. Now, the explanation could be, well, of course you couldn't have it as a real transmission. It was a secret transmission on a secret frequency that couldn't be picked up by ham radio operators.
That's true. That's true.
All I want to hear is anybody who has a recording that can be identified as being of the time and said by Neil Armstrong saying those things. Because my view is, and I suppose one could say it's a little bit cynical, is that this story about artifacts on the moon could be partially disinformation to persuade us that Neil Armstrong got to the moon in the first place to say it.
Mm-hmm.
Could be one explanation.
I see what you mean.
And the other explanation is that I know that Richard Hoagland is very enthusiastic about the idea of artifacts on the moon, and I've seen a lot of his presentations and his talks, and the evidence he comes up with is very persuasive.
True. Well, he pushes primarily Mars, but I do believe he also believes there's something going on the moon.
That's right. And he is obviously not going to be particularly enthusiastic about the idea that we didn't get there in the first place, because then his ideas wouldn't necessarily be particularly persuasive in themselves.
Marcus, stay with us. We've got two more hours to go with you, and we're wrapping up our first. We'll be back in a moment as we talk then about some of this photographic evidence. Compelling. And maybe they did alter some of the photographs and change them. But then there was a reason for that. I'll be back in a moment.
All the people who've ever been wishing on tomorrow, when will it come?
Want to time travel? Go back to past shows on Streamlink. Sign up online at coasttocoastam.com.
To follow where you are. Wishing on a dream.